ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
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 Let's sing this together.
Narayanam namaskritya Narayanam sarvanarottamam Devim sarasvatim vyasam Tato jayam udirayat Nashyakaishva bhadreshu Nidhyam parvatasevara Bhagavati namanam shope Bhagavati bhakti narishiti
Good morning, devotees.
Good morning.
It's nice to be here with all of you. So we're going to do three verses today. We're going to do 51, 2, 52, and 53, and then we'll do the Sanskrit for 53.
O King, your uncle Dhritarashtra, his brother Vidura, and his wife Gandhari have gone to the southern side of the Himalaya Mountains, where there are shelters of the great sages.
In text 52? Okay, I'll read it. The place is called Sapta Shrota, divided by seven, because there the waters of the sacred Ganges were divided into seven branches. This was done for the satisfaction of the seven great rishis. So almost like little islands, because when the river is divided like that, you have like a little sections for each of the sages. Okay, so I'm going to read the translation so you know the verse. On the banks at Sapta Shrota, Dhritarashtra is now engaged in beginning Ashtanga Yoga by bathing three times daily, in the morning, noon, and evening, by performing the Agnihotra sacrifice with fire, and by drinking only water. This helps one control the mind and the senses and frees one completely from thoughts of familial affection. Okay, let's do a Sanskrit. So let's do the word for word together. Snatva, by taking bath, anusavanam, regularly three times, morning, noon, and evening. Tasmin, in that branch is divided into seven. Putva, by performing the Agnihotra sacrifice. Shva, also, Agnim, in the fire. Yatavati, just according to the tenets of the scripture. Abhaksha, fasting by drinking only water. Upashanta, completely controlled, Atma, the gross senses and the subtle mind, Sa, Dhritarashtra, Asri, would be situated, Vigata, devoid of, Aishana, thoughts in relation with family welfare. Okay, who can read this verse? The verse again. Let's do the translation again.
On the banks of the Sapta Shrota, Dhritarashtra is now engaged in beginning Ashtanga Yoga by bathing three times daily, in the morning, noon, and evening, by performing the Agnihotra sacrifice with fire and by drinking only water. This helps one control the mind and the senses and frees one completely from thoughts of familial affection.
Okay. Purport. The yoga system is a mechanical way to control the senses and the mind and divert them from matter to spirit. The preliminary processes are the sitting posture, meditation, spiritual thoughts, manipulation of air passing within the body, or in other words, breathing techniques, and gradual situation in trance, facing the absolute person, Paramatma. Such mechanical ways of rising to the spiritual platform prescribe some regulative principles of taking bath daily three times, fasting as far as possible, sitting and concentrating the mind on spiritual matters, and thus gradually becoming free from vishaya, or material objectives. Material existence means to be absorbed in the material objective, which is simply illusory. House, country, family, society, children, property, and business are some of the material coverings of the spirit, Atma. And the yoga system helps one to become free from all these illusory thoughts and gradually turn towards the absolute person. So it's interesting how Prabhupada mentions that all of these things are coverings over the spirit. Usually, in other contexts, he talks about the body being a covering over the spirit. But so are all of these things, the house, the country, the family, society, children, all of those things are coverings. By material association and education, we learn simply to concentrate on flimsy things. But yoga is the process of forgetting them altogether. Why are they flimsy?
Temporary,
yeah, exactly. They're not really substantial, flimsy, right? Modern so-called yogis and yoga systems manifest some magical feats, and ignorant persons are attracted by such false things. Or they accept the yoga system as a cheap healing process for diseases of the gross body. But factually, the yoga system is the process of learning to forget what we have acquired throughout the struggle for existence. I'd like to stop there for a minute. Prabhupada's breaking up two different types of yoga systems. One is like magical feats. Can someone give me an example of that?
Walking on fire.
Exactly, yeah. Can you elaborate? Like what, for people who might not have heard of that?
There's branches of mystical yoga where you can attain all sorts of ways of mastering different aspects of the body, time and space, and one of them might be to, if you're not the body and you truly believe this and you don't have pain in the body and you can walk on coals and do all kinds of crazy things.
Yeah, and they do this a lot in India, like they'll walk. You'll see someone walk across coals, and then when they come off, they'll show their feet, and the feet are not blistered. They're just, same as before. So it's quite an amazing power of the mind over the body. That's what they're doing, these magical feats. And then Prabhupada would often talk about, there's one story where this yogi could make something manifest, like I think it was ashes or something from his hand, or fruit, okay? And then Prabhupada said that my magic fee is all of these devotees. Mm-hmm. That was another. So there was a lot of, especially in India, you see a lot of that, like yoga used for almost like entertainment purposes and like showing your talent, right? And then there's the other one he talks about, cheap healing, so using yoga as a cheap healing process for diseases of the gross body. And that would be more of a Western, both Eastern and Western, but you see it more often in America than you do the other one. So you see people going to the gym for a yoga class to maintain the body. So I would like to talk about, in this class, the positives and the pitfalls of this Ashtanga yoga system that we're reading about, Dhritarashtra was doing. So, first of all, Dhritarashtra was an elderly person. He wasn't young, right? And he's going off into the forest and are on the bank of the Ganges here. And southern side of the Himalaya Mountains. Okay, so there's, probably like a jungle and also some flat land. And he's doing these really austere things. He's bathing three times a day, regardless of the season, right? So that's three times a day. Then he's doing Agnihotra sacrifices every day, sitting by the fire, and only drinking water. So who here has done a only water fast for one day? Okay. Who here has done it for more than one day? Okay. Wow. Only water. That's amazing. So he was doing that every day for indefinitely. That was his new routine. And this is an older person. Him and his wife were old. And this kind of reminds us that austerity is not just for young people. So austerity is something, what do you think of when I say the word austerity? How do you feel when I say that? Yeah?
The yogi in the Bhagavad Gita's pictures.
Okay.
Is just really appreciated.
And how does that make you feel when you think about it?
Difficult.
Difficult, okay. Any other? Yeah.
Just giving up any material comforts.
Giving up material comforts, right? Yeah. And it's also a way to regulate the senses. So what are some austerities you do right now in your life? Waking up early? Mm-hmm. And what other?
Going to bed early.
Going to bed early. Ooh, that's a really difficult one. Yes. Chanting steady number of rounds every day.
Four rags,
yeah. So these are all, they're austere as long as we're still struggling with the senses. They become easier with time when we're absorbed in Krishna. But they are there as a framework for to learn how to control and like hone in the senses, which are like the five forces, you know, like running here and there all over the place. And we're trying to control them through these austere, these sadhana practices. They could be considered austerity, right? So here Dhritarashtra is doing these steady things to control the senses and not get distracted by, oh, what's today's meal, and, you know, things like that. So it creates a very peaceful mindset, very, as long as you're able to do it. If you do more austerity than you're capable of, then it becomes difficult. So some of the positives of, so Prabhupada mentions here, the preliminary processes are sitting posture, meditation, spiritual thoughts, breathing, and gradual situation in trance. So these are things that we see a lot of these days. Have you noticed that? Yoga, meditation, mindfulness, Zen, all these things are very popular, becoming more popular in recent decades. And I want to ask, what do you think are some of the positives of those techniques? Like when you, has anybody here done those before they came to Krishna consciousness? Okay? Yeah, quite a few, right? So what are some of the, maybe Kira, what is something that you, positive that you got out of it towards spiritual life?
I felt calmer and more connected.
Mm-hmm. What else?
Yeah. It's an opportunity to slow down against all of the kind of passionate energy that's so common.
Yeah.
Just to take a step back and reflect.
Mm-hmm. Good. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
I realized like that there was something else going on beyond what I could see. Like I was like, okay, there's something more here. So that's what I really realized.
Yeah. And physically. Probably felt pretty good, right? Like regulated, peaceful. Like the other day I was listening to a lecture or a talk by a 94-year-old neurologist who talks about the neurological benefits of meditation. And he's 95, I think, and he looked like he was 70. So just because he's been doing it for decades, right? So the effects on the physical body are also there. So these are all material, but they are positives, right? They're reasons why people go gravitate towards this, to find something beyond themselves, to feel clarity, feel like they're peaceful from the rush of life. Especially nowadays, there's a huge contrast in our lives. Like everybody, have you noticed wherever you go, there's just everybody's face is down looking at their devices, even when they're walking. I don't know how people don't bump into each other. Like, especially on campus, it's like a miracle that like everybody's just like walking with their heads down. In that kind of context, these techniques for coming into the mode of goodness are very appealing for people because they sense that if I do this little austerity, if I go to the gym every week or every day, or if I go to this meditation club and I breathe and I feel connected to myself, then they're actually experiencing the mode of goodness, which is very, it feels very good, mode of goodness. It's very peaceful and The pace of life is slower. Like when before I came to Krishna House, I was in Alachua working at the Ayurvedic Health Clinic for a couple of years. And they have patients that come from all over the country and they stay there and they get Ayurvedic treatments, they do yoga. And the whole environment in that center is very much slower pace of life. Like everybody's eating mindfully, chewing, and just that grounding energy, right? Like reduce the vata and all that. So it was actually, I could see how that environment is a very, very conducive for spiritual life because it helps slow down this constant chatter of the mind and of the senses, right? So, if it's since we've been talking about all these positives, I want to mention we could ask the question. Well, then, why are there pitfalls? Like, what's the problem then? Why isn't it just? Why don't we just all focus on those techniques? So, I was thinking about the game Chutes and Ladders. And most people know that game. So it's a children's board game, and it has ladders drawn on it, and then it has chutes. And you roll dice, and then wherever you land, you either get to climb up a ladder, or you just go all the way back to, you know, where you were in the beginning. And so it's this, it's a fun, entertaining game for children, but I was thinking about it in this context. So the Prabhupada's saying here that these practices are a step on the way to Krishna, right? So imagine you're in a staircase, and or you could think of a ladder, but in this case, the example works with stairs. So there's stairs, next stair, next stair. So here's the stair of mode of goodness, yoga, meditation, mindfulness, right? And then here's the next step, spiritual life, realizing, oh, I'm actually serving Krishna, gradually going up to the top step. Between those steps, this is just one way to picture it, and this is what I was thinking about with the chutes and ladders game, is a chute right here after the step. So if you're not careful, you can go from this step, this like nice mode of goodness platform, and then all of a sudden go down. What might that chute be?
Pride.
Pride, that's a good one. Yeah, and there's more than one. So pride is definitely one of the pitfalls. And can you explain why that would be?
As you come to a mode of goodness, you start to be healthier and more peaceful mind and just better lifestyle in general. And you start to see other people who don't have that. And you compare and judge them.
Yeah.
Become puffed up because of that. And you gain knowledge from a mode of goodness, so you know more than other people do.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's a really big pitfall. And that could actually extend to us as well, right? It's not just that, oh, those people that are doing yoga and meditation have the potential of becoming proud. Actually, that can happen in any spiritual organization where you think, hey, look, I have it all together. And those people are just, I don't know what they're doing at 5:00 in the morning, but I'm awake chanting. You know, that mentality of I'm better than others. My spiritual master, Indraduna Swami, likes to say that when we start to feel that pride coming in, just to turn around in our life, like, not literally, but figuratively, look back on how recently we were also struggling in that, like, quicksand of material life, right? Look back and go, oh, it wasn't, in the cosmic perspective, it wasn't that long ago at all. It was like a blink when I was also thinking on the body and all this stuff. So we're not better than other people, but we're just, at this moment, more fortunate, a little more fortunate, and if we can share that fortune with others. So that's one way to deal with the pride if it comes up in our spiritual experience. But yes, pride is definitely a potential pitfall for being in the mode of goodness. Yeah, Shruti.
Also, if there's a lot of austerity, then one can become hard-hearted and become just heavy on others and not give them a chance to grow spiritually.
Yeah, so kind of losing that empathy or compassion by getting hard-hearted. And again, this can happen in any practice where if I think, oh, I have all the regulations down and I'm just like, you know, so steady, and then not being able to empathize with someone else who's struggling, maybe, for example, getting up in the morning or anything that we do. So yeah, hard-hearted. What's another shoot? Do you have a pretendra?
Complacency, because you think that everything is so nice, it's always nice, that you think you don't want to get out of it anymore. You just want to be here and be part of nature and helping others, so.
Yeah. So life's pretty good. This world is not that bad, right?
Yeah.
Like, get comfortable. And Prabhupada talks about that a lot, like getting comfortable in the material world. Yeah, because Mota Goodness, like we were talking about, feels good. So, yes, Chanti.
thinking that you're the doer, that you got yourself there.
That's a big one.
Taking all your credit.
Yeah, and that is kind of connected to the pride one. Of yes, I'm the one who got here with all of my whatever it is, breathing, meditation, my techniques. Yes, that's definitely a big one. Yes.
Especially for people who get into meditation and in the mode of goodness, kind of trying to quiet the mind and stuff. When they get to that point where they think their mind is clear, they think that they retain some sort of liberation, so they get attached to the personal liberation. That's past the mode of goodness and more into like just.
Yeah, that's actually a really big one.
Attachment to the peace that in the sometimes they get a little taste of Brahman realization and they stop there.
Exactly. So I had that actually at the top of my list, that impersonalism. That's a huge, like if we think about the step and then the shoot or the drop. If you're not careful, you go down that chute, and Prabhupada calls that the last snare of Maya. And we see this a lot in the Western context. I'm not so familiar with yoga in India, so I don't know, probably there too. But this idea that like I just have to get connected to the divinity in me, and then soon that becomes, oh, I'm the divine, I am God, and like or let's all merge, we're all one. And there's just a lot of that kind of impersonal philosophy within that movement of yoga and meditation and all those things. So we're very close. You're so close, but so far if you're not careful, right? In the late 90s, or I'm just kind of thinking back on my life, like late 90s or early 2000s, I started hearing the term bridge preaching. I don't know exactly when that started. But it's a nice analogy of creating, if we're thinking of those steps, and we're thinking of this population of people who are really sincere about being in the mode of goodness, who are peaceful, who are, they're so close, right, to they're in their spiritual progress. But if we don't help, if they don't have this bridge that goes to the next step, then they have that possibility of falling to that snare of thinking, I am God, I am, it's all about me again, and it becomes selfish. Prabhupada, there was a story in the early, like 26 Second Avenue, where someone said, Prabhupada, I see a light every time I chant. And she was actually speaking with like happiness, kind of some pride, like, look, I'm making progress. And Prabhupada said, oh, just keep chanting, it'll go away. Prabhupada was really, like, he was very no-nonsense about this, like, this kind of illusory idea that I'm much more progressed than I am. You know, like, this, like, oh, if I just see lights, or if I think that I'm God, and, like, this kind of fluffy way of looking at things. So Prabhupada really, he always cut that very quickly. I'm also thinking of when Prabhupada was with Dr. Mishra in the early days, he was invited to kind of attend a joint retreat with Dr. Mishra. And I think it was up in New York, right, in the more peaceful part of New York State. And whenever Prabhupada would start giving his talks, a few of the yoga students of Dr. Mishra, so Dr. Mishra was this big impersonalist, really. But he had a huge following of very sincere mode of goodness. People were practicing the techniques. And he invited Prabhupada to come. Prabhupada would give kirtan, and all those people would be absorbed and dancing and ecstatic. And then as soon as Prabhupada would start talking about We're the servants of Krishna, and Krishna is the personal aspect of God, and how we're his servants, then people would start trickling out of the room, and there would only be like maybe a couple of them left, and all the devotees. So you can see how just that thing of being very close, but if not careful, very far, right? So in our interaction with people in those circles, they're actually really, a lot of them are very sincere and very eager to develop in their spiritual lives, from my experience. And there's different, obviously different people, but it's a huge potential for to introduce to them that the personal aspect of God is so much, it's so much beyond what where they are, and is so much more sweetness in that, so much fulfillment to the soul. That's what we're really hankering for, is that personal loving relationship with the Supreme Person. So there's the positives and the pitfalls, and we can help people by creating that bridge, right? So and helping them to come to the next level of seeing Krishna as a person. Sometimes that's touchy. We have to be careful too, because not everybody wants to hear it. So then we just let them do their thing, because if they're strong impersonalists, then it can be very... sometimes we just have to let them take their journey, you know, if they don't want to listen and don't want to hear that aspect of Krishna. But Prabhupada was very expert at interacting with each person in a way that was helpful for them in their spiritual life, like finding commonality and then helping them go to the next step. Like with George Harrison and, with George Harrison specifically, and the Beatles, but specifically George Harrison, he encouraged him to be a musician for Krishna. And George Harrison asked Prabhupada, so should I shave up and join? Like, I can, you know, come and join all of you. And Prabhupada said, no, just keep doing what you're doing, but do it for Krishna. So here's the kind of the summary of it all, is if we see, like, there's the positives and the pitfalls, what is the underlying motivation? That's the question we have to ask. So we might see two people doing the same activity, right? Two people are doing yoga, Ashtanga yoga. So they're doing maybe poses or meditation. Let's say they're both doing the sun salutation, right? Which is a yoga technique. One of them could be, their motivation could be, think about a spiritual person. What might their motivation be for doing that? For doing yoga, just like going to a gym and doing yoga.
To get better. Oh, a spiritual person?
Yeah, like a spiritual, like Krishna conscious devotee. What would their...
To keep the body and soul together to serve the best that they can.
Yeah, that's a nice expression, right? Keeping the body and soul together. That's a, Prabhupada coined that kind of phrase. Keeping the body and soul together. And for each person, that's going to look different. Some people are going to need to go on walks. Some people are going to need some stretching to keep their back good so they can chant japa. There's all these, you know, ways to connect it to Krishna. So everything in life can be connected to Krishna. There's no place in this world where you can't insert Krishna. You can't add Krishna and say, okay, like make this place a better place, or this activity, transcendentalize it. Krishna-ize it, Prabhupada sometimes said. A spiritual person could use yoga techniques. Prabhupada himself would every day get a massage for his health and to keep the body and soul together. For him, it was a massage was what he needed to do that. And someone who is looking at that from a kind of a hard-hearted place, like maybe Shruti Sagar mentioned, black and white, sort of like all or nothing, might think, why are you getting a massage every day? That seems like a mundane thing to do. You know, like, without that spiritual vision of realizing, Prabhupada is connecting that activity to his service directly. And sometimes for us, in our vision, we're not able to see that or understand it. For another example, Prabhupada would go on daily walks. So after he had a heart attack or a stroke in New York, it was difficult to know exactly what it was, but I think it was maybe a mini stroke or a heart attack. So in the early days in New York, so he was in the hospital, and the doctor said, unless you, they told his disciples, do you know the story?
Prabhupada was the doctor stepped out of the room and talked to a Prabhupada's disciple, especially Brahmananda, which made Brahmananda furious. And the doctor said, and Prabhupada could hear it, but they didn't know Prabhupada could hear. And the doctor said, "The problem is the old man prays too much. The old man prays too much. He needs some exercise." Now, Brahmananda wanted to lift the doctor up and throw him out. But Prabhupada heard that, and he said, "Yeah, I need some exercise." And that's where the morning walks began. With Prabhupada recognizing the doctor was Krishna's representative giving him advice. And I could say, when Prabhupada, let's say, was on a morning walk in his mid-70s, I was 20s. I had trouble keeping up. I mean, he went on a morning walk, he took it very seriously.
Yeah. Yeah, so he became very regulated in that activity of keeping the body fit for service. And that can be our mentality too, like in our journeys, to find this balance. Do you notice that balance is the most difficult thing? Have you ever noticed that?
Yes.
So we tend to go from one extreme to another, and we flip-flop, and that's the whole, like, all, I think it's human nature, like we see that everywhere. But to find that balance of realizing it's both and instead of either or, okay? So it's like, instead of thinking, oh, all yoga and meditation and all those things are just maya, and they're not, you know, like, and it's just completely being just chanting all day at the detriment of maybe our physical health, like that doctor was saying about Prabhupada's situation. So finding that balance of how am I going to use exercise or different things that are healthy for me, like maybe a certain type of food that we need or a certain sleep pattern, and then also connect that to Krishna. Like, how is that going to help me in my spiritual life? So finding things that can help us, and then they become transcendentalized by us using them in our service. Another example I was thinking of for meditation is the story of, in the Nectar Devotion, of that Brahmana in South India who was very poor, and he would go to these sanghas and listen to these devotees talking. And one time he heard that you can serve Krishna in your mind. Just, it's the same thing. Serving Krishna mentally is the same as serving him physically with our physical body. So this devotee of Krishna took this really seriously, and he thought, okay, let me start doing that practice. And you start meditating about collecting all these this Ganges water and big pots and all these different services in his mind. And then one day he thought, let me make
sweet rice.
Sweet rice, yes. And so everybody here has had sweet rice, right? So it's really tasty and it's a nice dish to offer. So he, in his mind, was boiling the pot and stirring and making the sweet rice, and then he thought, let me see if it's the right temperature to offer Krishna. So he tested it with his finger, and he went, ouch, in the meditation, in his mind. Ouch, that hurt. And it broke his meditation, and when he looked down at his finger, he saw that there was like a blister, or red, you know, like when you get burnt. And so it had physically affected his body. And Prabhupada I read the lecture of this where Prabhupada's telling the story, and he says, up in Vaikuntha, Lord Narayan was humorously laughing, looking down at the scene. He says Krishna gets touched when he sees that his devotees are so much wanting to serve him, and he was doing it so sincerely within his mind, not even physically stirring the pot, but just so much love in his mind, in his meditation. So then the Lord Narayan sent down a Vaikuntha airplane and collected this devotee, and that was the end of all material misery for that soul. So that's a really nice a way to dovetail meditative techniques in the service of Krishna. There was a Bhakti Chuswami in like the 80s, he told this in a lecture, and my parents, it stuck with my mother especially, she used to tell me the story, that he mentioned when Bhakti Chuswami said, when I'm sick, I actually really appreciate that opportunity to be lying in bed and being able to do service mentally, to practice that, going through every detail, and sometimes you can do it even more in your mind than you could physically do, right? So like, oh, I'm going to offer Krishna lotus flowers. Oh, we don't have any in Gainesville, so we can do it mentally, right? So that he said that, and it's relevant to all of us because there's always going to be, for each one of us, there's going to be a time in our life where we're lying in bed, completely out of commission physically, and we can use that, a meditation, spiritual meditation, transcendentalizing that to serve Krishna. So those are ways to kind of, so either using the exercises and techniques to support our body and soul, keeping them together, or using them to actually, like the spiritual version of them. Those are two ways to dovetail those in Krishna consciousness. So any questions or comments? Yes, Animesh.
Reminds me of the past that I've been taking to them with Nrisimhananda Brahmachari. What he did was that as Mahaprabhu was heading to Vrindavan, he wanted to offer something to Mahaprabhu. So in his mind, he created a beautiful path leading up to Vrindavan. And it was strewn with flowers and nice lakes and ponds everywhere. And as Mahaprabhu was walking, though he was walking through Bengal, but he was seeing exactly what Nrisimhananda Brahmachari had created for him.
Yeah, it's so touching, isn't it? It's such a touching pastime that Krishna was actually there. Lord Chaitanya was experiencing that service that devotee offered in his mind. That's so sweet, yeah. Because I'm sure that Lord Chaitanya's the physical journey would have been the dusty roads and the, you know, like whatever was there at the time. Nowadays it would be like honking rickshaws. But in his mind, he created this wonderful path for Lord Chaitanya and this really wonderful service. So, yeah. Any other? Yes.
As part of our work in the Bhaktivedanta Institute, we have a big issue, a lot of big issues. And one of the issues is what's the story of, excuse me, of evolution? What's actually happening? And it seems, give me 100 years or 200 years, and I'll give you a little better insight. But for now, there's the big mystery Sariputta brought up is comes in a scientific theory, I won't go into now, called information theory. There's so much information mathematically calculated. And as the evolutionary sequence occurs, there's more information. Things are much more complicated. I mean, you know, all of you are much more than an amoeba, though some people I know seem to be less. and so where does it come from? Well, one solution seems to be in something called epigenetics, that our conscious will can actually affect the genes. And 20 years ago, this was an outlier theory. Now it's becoming mainstream. And it seems that our research is going along that line. In other words, it's the conscious will of what we see it in Prabhupada gives the example that a caterpillar has a will and becomes a butterfly. That's kind of a crude example for this, but it works. And so there's will. So our will has such a huge impact. And the point where you're saying the yogis, they have a will. And it takes them so far, so you have to have a certain a clearness of mind, and it helps bring that clearness of mind. But then, if that clearness of mind is never connected to seva, it never reaches our true nature, then it does become, I thought it was a perfect example, my old favorite game as a three-year-old, chutes and ladders, that you can go down the chute because it's not satisfying our inner nature. So our will is extremely important, even in an evolutionary sense, in every sense. And so our will needs to, ultimately, our will is best connected to our nature. And the yogis, the shoot is missing their nature. But it's goodness. It's good. Yeah. But it's missing their nature.
Yeah, and then it becomes like, it's not sustainable then. It leads to like wanting to do some activity in the material world. You tend to like go, okay, let me at least do something good for people, and it quickly, spirals down if it's not connected to our real nature. Thank you. So one more final point is, Prabhupada says that all we need to do, he gives the example of a rich man's son, and he says that boy really just needs to stay alive to inherit the wealth of his father when the father leaves the body. So he says, similarly, we have to stay alive spiritually, but also maintaining the body so that we are able to serve as long as possible in this life, because we have such a rare gift, such a rare opportunity. So if we can find ways to live a balanced life and to sustain the body and the mind as long as possible and keep serving, then we have the best of both worlds. So thank you so much for listening and being here. Hare Krishna.